So to underpin his claim, William decided to establish a military force in these territories. And this force was created on the 26th of October 1814 and was called the Marechaussee. The reason or purpose for the founding of the Marechaussee was that was given was to uphold the law, ensure public order, and guard the security of the citizens in the territories in Belgium. And in the founding document, in the founding document, there was no mention of at all of any political motive that the Prince of Orange might have had. And then we find we have to return a little in time and go to the gendarmerie in the Low Countries. To the southern and northern part of the Low Countries, this police organization was nothing new. Revolutionary and later Napoleonic France had exported the gendarmerie to the Low Countries, and this was done in several stages. After the Dutch Republic had become more or less a satellite state of France after 1795, the Dutch Republic adopted this system, so the Marechaussee's gendarmerie system, and created the so-called Bataafse gendarmerie. And Bataafse is the word for an old Germanic tribe which lived in the Netherlands around the year zero. The Bataafse gendarmerie was established. The southern territories were annexed by France and had no choice but except being policed by the French gendarmerie. The architect of the gendarmerie in the Low Countries was the French general of the gendarmerie, Etienne Radet, who would set the standards for years to come. And the French gendarmerie was never popular, and by most citizens seen as an instrument of French oppression. And one of the reasons of this unpopularity was that France, after the annexation of the South, introduced conscription. And many young men, of course, like nowadays, evaded this compulsory service by going north. From these refugees, money could be made, and lines of escape were formed. The French gendarmerie tried to end these activities by infiltrating these groups of people who supplied the servants and arrest them. And of course, they could not do this in uniform, so they used civilian clothes. They sat in taverns and inns and spied on everybody who could be a potential enemy of France. After 1810, the year the northern provinces were annexed, this was no longer necessary. From then on, the French gendarmerie was everywhere and unavoidable. And then a continuation or break with the past. William himself was very aware of this negative reputation the gendarmerie had gained during the French occupation. And this was the reason why he personally crossed out the word gendarmerie in the draft document and changed it to Marechaussee. I can show you that. This is the one. This is the original. And in top, you can see that the word gendarmerie is crossed out. Mm-hmm. And William himself put in Marechaussee. This way he tried to suggest a break with revolutionary and imperial France. This was, of course, wishful thinking, and as most people saw the newly established Marechaussee as the natural heir of the French gendarmerie. This unpopularity was also one of the main reasons for William to restrict the Marechaussee's field of operation to the southern provinces. The other reason was that in October 1814, it was still not clear how the future borders would be drawn, and the presence of the Marechaussee in the south was a clear political sign to France and Prussia of William's claim to this territory. And the first post or brigade was set up, Marechaussee, was set up in the garrison town of Maastricht, which is now the Dutch province of Limburg. And from then on it went quick, the expansion of the Marechaussee in the south. From the end of 1814, the expansion went ahead quickly. And in 1815, there were already 9 territorial departments in the south, which contained 164 brigades or posts that were manned by approximately 1,200 Marechaussees and officers. could find this. And here you have these brigades over Luxembourg and Belgian territory. These brigades were to be found in Belgium, as you can see, and Luxembourg, and part of Zeeland and Limburg, which is now part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. In 1818, the Dutch province of Noord-Brabant was added, and the name Marechaussee became Royal Marechaussee. And most members of the corps that were recruited originated from the southern provinces, since which territories were predominantly Roman Catholic. This in contrast to the north, where Protestant faith prevailed. And after Napoleon's final defeat at Waterloo in June 1815, international matters could be settled. During the conference of Vienna, it was decided that the Low Countries could be united in one kingdom. Prince William became its first king, and he took the name of William I. But this was an unhappy marriage, this united kingdom. What William called the l'amalgame le plus parfait never materialized. This, however, was an illusion, since most of the southerners distrusted this Protestant king. And no matter how much he tried, William never became popular in this part of his realm. In the years up to 1813, he tried to expand the Royal Marechaussee into the northern provinces, but he failed, and the reasons were twofold. Firstly, there was not enough money to realize this expansion. And secondly, the prevailing opinion amongst the opposition in the north was that in this Protestant, God-fearing part of the country, there was no need for an oppressive force, police force, like the Royal Marechaussee. And in 1830, several European countries were confronted with revolutionary movements. And the United Kingdom of the Netherlands was no exception. The situation in this country had a special dimension because of the discontent with William's policies in the south. The political elite were mostly oriented on France, and the Catholic clergy disagreed in many matters with the king. In the year 1830, the inevitable happened. In the evening of the 25th of August, an opera was performed in Brussels. The theme of this opera was the struggle for independence in Naples from the Spanish. And emotions ran high, and before the end of the opera, crowds took to the street to voice their wish for Belgian independence too. Authorities were totally lost on what to do. Houses of dignitaries were ransacked, and the Belgian uprising had begun. Some 50 Marechaussees were present in the city that evening. Some detachments were ordered to quell the riots. On horseback, they proceeded to the heart of the fighting, and on arrival, they could do nothing. The street was filled with debris and furniture, and the lighting had been put out of action by the crowd. So the Royal Marechaussee returned to the barracks without having made a mark. And on September the 3rd, the Marechaussee left Brussels for Antwerp. After Brussels, more towns in the southeast joined the rebellion against the king. I have one picture of the Marechaussee, how Dutch Marechaussee looked in 1814, and you can clearly see the familiarity with the gendarmerie, the French gendarmerie. So the rupture between of the United Kingdom was unavoidable and had, of course, far-reaching consequences for the Royal Marechaussee. In the month following the start of the uprising, the brigades in rural Belgium were still capable of holding out. The situation worsened considerably after crowds from the rebellious towns took to the countryside to spread revolution to villages and hamlets. Rebels roamed the countryside and succeeded in isolating the brigades, Marechaussees, who were responsible for delivering letters with information and intelligence, were intercepted and their letters opened. Others who transported prisoners had to hand them over and were hindered to return to their brigades. Situations became sometimes very dangerous when rebels tried to capture weapons and horses. The brigade of the city of Halle had to retreat after hearing that an armed group of 15 men were on their way to take their weapons and horses. The brigade of the town of Jodogne had to leave its post when 80 armed rebels appealed to the same idea. This deteriorating situation was very bad for the morale. And at the end of September, the rebellion arrived in the duchy at the borders of the Duchy of Limburg. And as a precaution, the brigade of the Royal Marechaussee in the city of Liège had retreated into the citadel of the city after they lost their horses to mutineers who chose the Belgian cause. So the position of the brigade surrounding the city of Liège became untenable. The men were pulled back on the heavily fortified city of Maastricht, and thus they could, of course, not check the spread of the rebellion. In the towns and hamlets in the triangle of Maastricht, Sittard, Heerlen, the population became unruly, which is, you could say, the south of the province of Limburg. And on the 9th of October, a gang of armed men entered the village of Heerlen. It took little convincing to persuade the mayor and the rest of the population to change sides, so they were quite willing. Worse was that the mayor ordered the brigade, so the Marechaussee brigade, to assist with this secession, and the men complied. A few days after this event, the brigade commander and one of his men chose to desert to the other side. Desertion became a common thing within the army and the Royal Marechaussee. Commanders were quick to grasp that the only way to avert complete disaster for the north was to get all potential deserters out of the army and, of course, the Royal Marechaussee. And on the 21st of October, 2 months after the beginning of the uprising, officers, non-commissioned officers and Marechaussees were given a free choice. They could either leave or they could stay. If they wanted to set the second choice, they had to swear allegiance to King William I. Those who wouldn't make a choice were to be discharged and sent home. This, of course, meant a serious loss for the Royal Marechaussee, because after this happened, from the 1,200 men in total, only 350 opted for the north. So most of them went for the south. In October 1830, the Marechaussee had to retreat from virtually the whole of the province of Limburg. All major cities, as far as Venlo and beyond, were in the hands of the Belgians. I have one picture here of the situation of the uprising in October 1830. So you can see the spreading of the uprising of totally over the poor province of Limburg, the Dutch, which is now Holland. So the province was, for the most part, in hands of the Belgians. An exception was Maastricht, which would hold out until a settlement was reached almost 9 years later. The North tried to keep control of the canal, which ran from 's-Hertogenbosch in Brabant to Maastricht, and which was therefore of strategic importance. The brigades, who were situated along this canal, tried to protect it. The effort was null and void because the Limburgs dug through the dike at two spots. Shipping traffic was made impossible this way, and brigades were dismantled. So it was no use at all to have brigades there. There was, for years to come, no role to play for the Royal Marechaussee. Instead, the Belgian provisional government established a provisional Belgian gendarmerie. Only Maastricht, as I mentioned earlier, remained an isolated outpost of the north in an hostile land. And William was not content with this situation, so he began a counteroffensive. And at the end of 1830, the expansion of the uprising had reached its limits. And out of Limburg, rebels tried to stir the population of North Brabant into resistance against King William and to come over on their side. There was some sympathy for the Belgian cause, but protest was mainly motivated by discontent towards the arrogant Hollanders. Furthermore, the Dutch had mobilized their army, which was now almost free from deserters from the south, and this army was camped in the province of North Brabant, so the civilian population could be held in check. And part of this army was a squadron or company of Marechaussees. Most of these men were driven from the south and were now used to police the army and for reconnaissance. They were regularly confronted with Belgian forces and fought skirmishes with varied success. The stalemate between the two enemies could not last forever. William was stubborn, and he didn't intend to accept the situation. And after some futile negotiations, the king decided to act with military means. And on the 2nd of August 1831, He ordered an offensive by the army against Belgium. His son led the troops who advanced south on a broad front, and the offensive was very successful. The Belgian army was not able to stem the onslaught and fled the field. And on the 12th of August, the north entered the city of Louvain. The French were not inclined to see the north emerge victorious and moved an army north. Having come this close to victory, William's troops nevertheless had to retreat. The campaign lasted just for 10 days and was the last Dutch military action until the Second World War. And then there began a conflict of loyalties. The Marechaussees fought alongside the regular troops, and it was a non-commissioned officer of the Royal Marechaussee who dealt the first blow with a saber and wounded a Belgian foe. One Marechaussee was killed by a cannonball in what was later was called the Battle for Boutersum near Louvain. And of course, they were not all heroes. An example, which I like, a very nice example, is the case of the Marechaussee called Thomas. In 1843, a few years after a settlement was reached, he wrote to the district chief of the Royal Marechaussee, and he wanted his papers because he was about to retire, and the Dutch state owed him, that was his opinion, 300 guilders, quite an enormous amount of money to these days. The district chief wrote to his boss that the man had gone on the 10 days campaign, which I mentioned, the 10 days against the war in against Belgium, and he was taken prisoner on the second day of war by the Belgians. And he changed sides and had become brigade commander of the Belgian gendarmerie in the town of Hasselt in Belgian Limburg. So, according to the district chief, he owed the state 111 guilders because he had taken 2 horses on campaign, which were taken prisoner as well. And this money was gone. But the Marechaussee would return to Limburg. And at the end of the 10 days campaign, I can show you, that's before I forget that, a little intermezzo. The sources I use are from the what is called Brievenboeken in Dutch. It's you should understand it by Livre de Lettres. So all things which were worth noticing, what happened on a day, were noted. Written down, exactly. And this one is a Brievenboek from 1843. And if you look a little now, well, you can read it from this distance, but these two arrows are made, is this story of this Marechaussee Thomas. So you find all sort of stuff in these books, which is quite amazing, never used. So they're still there, and almost 200 years old. But the Marechaussee would return to Limburg, and at the end of the 10 days campaign on August 1831 marked the beginning of a stagnant period in the relations between the Kingdom of Belgium and the Kingdom of the Netherlands. It took William almost a decade to accept that a restoration of the situation before August 1830 was an illusion. And in 1839, he grudgingly accepted the Treaty of London. And in this treaty, it was stipulated that the Duchy of Limburg, on the eastern side of the River Meuse, would become part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands, and that the city of Maastricht would stay Dutch territory as well. Although William got a good deal, he was frustrated and he abdicated in 1840 to make room for his successor. And after the treaty had been signed, the Royal Marechaussee prepared to enter the lands it had to vacate under the threat of force in 1830 and to join with comrades in the city of Maastricht. On the 3rd of August, just before they entered the province of Limburg, Captain Hoppenbrouwers, the commander, spoke to his men. And in his speech, he accentuated to his men that it had been the king's wish that the population would be treated with respect and patience. Arrogance of the victor towards the vanquished was to be avoided. The Limburgers were brothers and sisters deluded by diabolical propaganda from the south. Now they returned to become an indissoluble part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands. The enthusiasm for a renewed union with the northerners wasn't great, to say the least. The people had made it abundantly clear in 1830 that they wanted nothing to do with Holland, and the Marechaussees who went to their brigades all over the province were looked upon as foreigners and representatives of a Protestant king. The welcome was certainly not a warm one. In 1848, the already strained relations between the Royal Marechaussee and the population of the province of Limburg were tested again. Like in 1830, revolutions took place in Europe. The threat for the Kingdom of the Netherlands came now not from the south, but from the east. In Germany, there were voices which claimed that the territories east of the River Meuse should belong to Prussia. For the Dutch government, this meant a real threat against the Dutch sovereignty over these lands. The answer had to be steadfastness and the clear intention that Limburg should stay within the kingdom. The point was that most Limburgers had no love for Prussia. The revolutionary zeal more or less rekindled the old wish to become part of the Belgian kingdom. This became manifest in how the population reacted to the Royal Marechaussee after having a drink. They taunted and insulted Marechaussees by venting their dislike of the Hollanders and praising Belgium. Marechaussees who entered a tavern in Roermond were welcomed by shouts like "Moors Hollandais, vive la Belgique." The commander of this patrol mentioned later that it was a close call. He and his men were almost forced to use their weapons. In the same city, a member of the city council spoke to a crowd in front of the town hall, and he was interrupted by a man who was accompanied by his six-year-old daughter, and he said that he knew they were hiding a Belgian tricolore in the attic. He suggested to fetching it so he could make himself a waistcoat and a dress for his little daughter. Two Marechaussees were present and acted on suspicion of separatism, and the man had to go to court. And this all seems rather innocent in our eyes, but Commander Hoppenbrouwers was deeply concerned. He still remembered the problems of 1830 very well. That year, the Marechaussees had been driven from their brigades and out of the duchy. For Hoppenbrouwers, there was no doubt that this could happen again. In secrecy, he began planning for a worst-case scenario. If resistance against Marechaussee would grow to intolerable levels, the men were to retreat in fortified positions, the cities of Maastricht and Venlo. Another question was, what was wise in these circumstances? Being lenient or being firm? The authorities chose the last, and the Royal Marechaussee had to hold its ground and act whenever they saw signs of separatism or when they were insulted. The tactic worked. The Royal Marechaussee never retreated from the Limburg countryside in the years that followed. The relations between the population and military policemen gradually improved and became sometimes even cordial. The history of the Royal Marechaussee and the Dutch province of Limburg became closely intertwined, and the Marechaussee, or the Blue Ones, as they were called, became an integral part of Southern society. Thank you for your interest.